Hello, everybody. Thank you all so much for coming. We're going to get started. We don't have a mic. Yeah. So, hello, everybody. I'm going to try and be as loud as possible. We have another classroom class coming in at 12:30, so we're going to have to pretty much exit at around 12:15-ish. So we're going to get started right away. So my name is Jake Wilson. I'm a professor of sociology at CSULB. I'd like to welcome you all here to this timely intellectual talk, Palestine, Occupation, Settler Colonialism, and Apartheid, by Professor David Lloyd, Distinguished Professor of English at UCR, UC Riverside. Before we begin, I'd like to recognize and acknowledge the Native people whose land we gather upon here today. CSULB is located on the sacred site of Puvungna. We acknowledge that we are on the land of the Tongva Gabrieleño and the Hachiman and Wanyeno nations who have lived and continue to live here. We also recognize the Tongva Hachiman nations and their spiritual connection as the first stewards and the traditional caretakers of this land. We respect and value the many ways the Tongva Hachiman culture, heritage, and beliefs continue to have significance to the living people and remind us about the sacred and spiritual relationship that has always existed here on what we now call CSULB. We thank them for their strength, perseverance, and resistance. Today, as Israel continues to bomb civilians seeking shelter, it is critical that we also reflect on the situation in Gaza and the West Bank. Palestinians have lived under occupation for decades and have endured severe water, food, and medical supply shortages, unreliable access to electricity and other utilities, limited employment and educational opportunities, restricted freedom of movement, economic blockades, imprisonment, torture, and other widespread conditions and policies that lead to premature death. The violence currently being perpetrated by Israel in Gaza, with the political and financial support of the United States and much of the West, will lead to further long-term or permanent displacement of Palestinians from their homelands as they continue to fight for sovereignty and survival in the face of genocide and mounting settler colonial violence. We hope this discussion today gives the audience a deeper understanding of the situation in Gaza in particular. I want to thank all the co-sponsoring departments, also the CLA Dean's Office, especially the departments of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, English, and Sociology, and my fellow faculty workers who are here today, including those who invited their students to this event. Special thanks to all the incredible student activists who are here. We are here today and appreciate your voice, your courage, and your perseverance. Please know your professors see you and appreciate you all very, very much. I'd also like to acknowledge a special guest here today. Dr. Sandra Hale is joining us today for this talk. Professor Hale is an activist scholar who co-founded Feminists in Support of Palestinian Women, founder and coordinator of the Darfur Task Force, founder and coordinator of California Scholars for Academic Freedom, and co-founder of the U.S. Committee for the Academic Boycott of Israel. Thank you for being here, Dr. Hale, and for inspiring so many of us to do this work. I would like to remind the audience that this is an intellectual scholarly event. A number of professors have invited students in their classes here today, so we are treating this event in the exact same way as we would any regular classroom space. I'd also like to remind the audience members of CSULB's campus rules and regulations regarding academic freedom, free speech, and the expectations for conduct at campus intellectual events, which is also available on CSULB's website. While the audience is free to have their own opinions, including disagreeing vehemently with Dr. Lloyd's perspectives or mine, they may not disrupt today's event in any way. As a courtesy, we request that nobody record or take pictures of the people at this event. A university photographer does have permission to be here, and they may come and take pictures. I believe they're already here. Thank you for coming, Debbie. Dr. Lloyd's talk will be audio recorded for a podcast. We will have a Q&A after Dr. Lloyd's talk is over, but since there are so many people here, we ask that you please write your questions down on index cards. So I will pass those out, and as will Dr. Asuna. And we will do our best to incorporate as many as we can, including very hard questions, okay? Time permitting. Academic freedom is rooted in the idea that the common good depends upon the free search for truth and its free exposition. This includes freedom to research and teach. CSULB remains committed to academic freedom as educational institutions can advance knowledge and truth only by being open to the contestation of ideas. This means protecting scientific, literary, artistic, and political speech as a condition of thought. That being said, earlier this week, the very foundation of academic freedom at CSUOB came under attack. This week alone, over 2,000 emails were sent by external pro-Israel political organizations and individuals to CSUOB administrators and department chairs demanding cancellation of this intellectual event. These emails were part of a coordinated effort by pro-Israel political groups to pressure CSUOB leaders to censor Palestine-centered events. These emails came from all around the country, including New York and San Diego. These emails were full of false statements and grossly unfounded allegations to defame Dr. Lloyd and the co-organizers of this event and to prevent critical intellectual discussions of Palestine on our campus. But I want to be clear, this is not just a problem we are facing here at CSUOB. Rather, these attacks on academic freedom and free speech go well beyond this event and even Dr. Lloyd. As global criticism mounts over Israel's violation of Palestinian human rights and international law, well-funded campaigns to silence and repress those of us who speak out against Israeli apartheid and U.S. complicity have grown at an alarming rate. In many ways, the attack on Dr. Lloyd's talk is an attack on all of us here today who are invested in humanity, dignity, and freedom. The coordinated campaign to censor Dr. Lloyd this week reminded me about my own experiences here at CSUOB about a decade ago. In 2014, I was a much younger professor. My partner and I had an infant, a two-year-old, and at that time, I was the faculty advisor for Students for Justice for Palestine, or in Palestine. Israel had just bombed Gaza in what was called Operation Protective Edge, a euphemism for the high-tech U.S.-subsidized murder of Palestinian civilians and children. Thousands of Palestinians were killed and injured and displaced. The student activists, SJP, wanted to find a way to directly help Gazan children and requested my assistance to organize a blanket solidarity drive as a form of humanitarian relief. So we organized a film screening of the documentary film Roadmap to Apartheid, followed by a talk by a speaker from American Muslims for Palestine. Dozens of sociology students and SJP organizers collected hundreds of brand new blankets and arranged for a shipping container, which was very expensive, to be sent from the port of Long Beach to Palestine. After the event, a pro-Israel professor complained to the CLA dean and sociology department chair that I created a hostile environment. By showing the film, inviting a speaker she claimed supported terrorism, offering extra credit, and for me, wearing a t-shirt that had Arabic print on it. She said that having Arabic on your shirt was intimidating. The shirt said Palestine and was a gift that a SJP student brought back from the West Bank for me. Students were harassed and doxxed, and I believe that I was going to be fired. All this for organizing an intellectual event. That was an incredibly chilling experience for my family and I, one that isn't necessarily, though, distinct to me. I wasn't prepared to deal with the attack on my academic freedom and the attack on my college service and my students as an advisor to a student organization. I did not feel I had any support on campus, including even from my own union. I had to find a lawyer, but in this life-changing experience, I was introduced to an incredible network of very principled people who offered me support and guidance in navigating the treacherous waters of the pro-Israel political lobby. I'm not sure if he remembers, but one of those people who helped me immensely during this challenging time when I had two little babies was Professor David Lloyd. Prior to that, I had never met Dr. Lloyd. Without even knowing me, he offered me unwavering solidarity, kindness, encouragement, and support, which is something that I will treasure for the rest of my life. As such, today is deeply personal for me to be in this space with you all, a decade after I thought I could lose my livelihood, surrounded by so many inspiring coworkers, students, and our esteemed guest, Professor David Lloyd. Dr. Lloyd is Distinguished Professor of English at UC Riverside. Professor Lloyd's work primarily focuses on Irish culture and post-colonial and cultural theory, and teaches courses on Irish literature, poetry, and poetics, and post-colonial and settler colonial cultural studies. Dr. Lloyd is the author of numerous books and articles and a founding member of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Please join me in welcoming Professor David Lloyd.
Thank you so much, Jake. I really appreciate that. And I do, now that you remind me, totally remember that occasion. And Sandra Hale, who I'm very glad to see here, is also a member of that group, California Scholars for Academic Freedom, that steps up to protect people who are attacked, not only around the question of Palestine, though that's perhaps the most prevalent, but around other matters as well. So if there are faculty here who aren't a member of that network, you might want to step up and we'll see if we can add you to the list. That's kind of amazing, isn't it? 2,000 letters asking to cancel this event. That's a lot of people. I feel sorry for them, really. Partly because, you know, there's a bibliography I'm going to post at the end of this talk. And they could find better reading material there, I think, than reading Canary Mission and looking for people who are the demons of Israel hate. I think of them now as the Zioborg, or for those of you who never watched Star Trek, the Ziobot, because they seem to generate these emails very automatically and probably from a kind of central template that they generate very quickly. I've had many, many of these emails sent to me personally in the past. And the trouble with it is, we're here not to censor. We're here to open discussion and to have free, frank, and clear discussion of all the issues that are raised by the question of Palestine and the question of Israel. There are many ways in which they try to censor us, not the least of which is invoking the spurious International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, most of whose examples of anti-Semitism are actually criticism of the state of Israel or of the political philosophy of Zionism. I'm not so stupid as to confuse Zionism and Judaism or Zionists with Jews. That would be, of course, to completely malign the venerable traditions of Jewish anti-Zionism. And it would also to be engaged in a certain kind of racism, which would suggest that just because you're Jewish, you have to support a state that many of us, for reasons that I'm explaining today, think of as a settler colonial enterprise running an apartheid regime in the historic territory of Palestine. I've been accused often enough of Israel hating. But at a moment when 30,000 and more Palestinians have been killed in Rezga, and hundreds also on the West Bank who tend to fly under the radar of our news media these days, I think, wow, the murder of 30,000 civilians and more still unaccounted for under the rubble of destruction, including 10,000 children, meaning 20,000 women and men. And I'm not going to cut out the men, because that's to play into Israeli propaganda that suggests that any man killed in Gaza must have been a terrorist, must have been a Hamas supporter. 20,000 people have been killed. In the course of this, Israeli leaders have stated their genocidal reasons for conducting this assault. You can look at the statements of the Minister for Security, Ben-Gvir, or the Minister for Finance, Smotrich, who I'll come back to in a moment, and see what they are saying about needing to clear Gaza. Look at the photographs online or the videos online of the festival they held proposing to clear Gaza of Palestinians in order to rebuild Jewish settlements there. Think of the total destruction of civil infrastructure in Gaza, the hospitals, the universities, the schools, the cultural buildings. All this is completely in line with what the Israeli military called the Dahiya Doctrine, which was developed in an Israeli university and which proposes that Israeli campaigns of war, whether against Gaza or against Lebanon, and you'll remember that they threatened to flatten Beirut in the same way as they're flattening Gaza. Dahiya was a suburb of Lebanon, flattened in the 2006 war, and it is now Israeli military policy to go after civilian infrastructure and destroy it in order, in a counterinsurgency campaign, to separate or alienate the civilian population from the freedom fighters, the terrorists, the guerrillas, whatever term you and your perspective like to use. But the idea is that something that is forbidden by the Geneva Convention and humanitarian and international law, the targeting of civilian infrastructure is well within the bounds of Israeli military doctrine. They've also killed, and this touches me nearly, poets and writers. Rafat Al-Arir assassinated on December the 6th by a targeted Israeli strike along with his family. Mossab Abu Toha, who was arrested by Israeli forces, beaten up, and then fortunately had a child with an American passport who was born here and managed to leave through the Rafah crossing, something that seems increasingly unlikely to be possible for many more Gazan Palestinians. The open fascism of the current government, represented most clearly in Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who I've just mentioned. But, of course, the fascistic tendency, as I'll be pointing to later, is a tendency of all settler colonialisms. It is not accidental. It's not a freak or an anomaly that these people are now in a right-wing Israeli government. And then apartheid, to which I'll come in a moment. All these are practices that any right-thinking person would detest and repudiate. It makes no sense to hate a state. What does it mean to hate a state? I'm not an Israel hater, but certainly I hate right now what Israel is doing, what it's practicing in Gaza. And I hope that any person with a moral conscience would repudiate what Israel is doing. From the White House and Butcher Biden down to ourselves here, we need to repudiate those actions. To repudiate those actions is not to say that it is not possible for Israelis and Palestinians ever to live together in peace. Most Palestinians that I have met have no idea of clearing Israeli Jews from the land. What they say is, let us live in peace and let us enjoy our rights. And that is what decolonization of Palestine might mean. Jake mentioned and asked me to mention the fact that I was born in Ireland and work mostly on Ireland and our experience of colonization. When I was 13, for reasons that are not important, I was sent to school in Belfast in the north of Ireland as a young lad who'd grown up in Dublin, in the Republic of Ireland, down south. And when I got to the school, I was taken aside by a young man who came up to me and said, "Come here, you," he said, "you're a wee Fenian from the south," and Fenian is a rebel. "You're a wee Fenian from the south," he said. "You don't know, but I can tell you, Catholics got their eyes too close together." Now, if any of you went to Ireland, you'd just see a bunch of white people. We all look the same. But this Protestant kid, who happened to be the son of a then-governing minister in the Northern Irish Parliament, was convinced that there was a racial difference that you could tell. And it's a very specific term used in Northern Ireland, you can tell. Told me that I needed to learn that racial division. So where did it come from? Well, after the Irish uprising that started on Easter Monday in 1916, there was a prolonged anti-English war of decolonization, which ended in a treaty in 1922, which divided the island of Ireland into two parts. Let me just leave you with a thought here. The map of Ireland, the pink things that are up in the northeast corner, are the six counties that were divided from the island of Ireland to constitute a separate political entity called Northern Ireland. That entity was particularly designed to have only six counties, even though the purpley-blue ones, Donegal, Sligo, and Leitrim, actually form part of Ulster, the province out of which Northern Ireland was carved. These six counties were chosen in order to ensure a demographic majority of Protestant Irish people that would be, for the foreseeable future, permanent. So Ireland was divided into two entities, the Republic down south, which although majority Catholic, had at least on paper a non-sectarian constitution, and a Northern Ireland which was specifically designed to preserve Protestant supremacy over Catholics. It was called by its first prime minister a Protestant state for a Protestant people. Hold that phrase in your mind and you'll see where I'm coming from. They used the tactics of gerrymandering constituencies to maintain political domination, of discrimination in housing and employment, where a Catholic would never be promoted if there was a Protestant who could take the job. The police force was almost entirely Protestant, with very few exceptions. And unusually in the British Isles, where you know most of the police in England, Scotland, and Wales are unarmed, in Northern Ireland they were armed. They were a paramilitary police force. Why? Of course, to keep down the rebels. As a result, the population was ghettoized, divided into Catholic and Protestant neighborhoods. Of course, the Protestant neighborhoods got better facilities, better infrastructure, better housing. The Catholic ones got the lesser housing and were naturally poorer because employment was difficult. It took a civil rights movement inspired by the American Civil Rights Movement, and then an IRA campaign which was sparked by British military practices of internment and of massacre, Bloody Sunday of 1972 being the prime example, that brought back an IRA that had gone dormant, which then fought an insurgency against the British Army's occupation of Ireland for 30 years. The peace process that resulted, the Good Friday Agreement that came out of it, was only possible because of external pressure. The Protestants, and even indeed the British government, would not have succumbed to allowing the dissolution of the Northern Irish Parliament and its reconstruction as a power-sharing government without that external pressure. So one of the things that I will be saying at the end is that only our external pressure is going to change the situation on the ground in historic Palestine and in Israel. Now, of course, in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin is the largest party, as it is in the Republic. Things can change. Decolonization, even a partial decolonization, can take place. In my view, Northern Ireland was in effect an apartheid state, a state in which the supremacy of one part of the population, which happened to be at that point a majority because of the way Northern Ireland was structured and boundaried, were able to maintain that superiority over another part of the population, which, had Northern Ireland not been carved off, would have been part of the majority. It was a Protestant state for a Protestant people in the same way as South Africa was a white state for a white people at the expense of the black majority. In my view, Northern Ireland was also a settler colony, a settler state, in its attitudes and practices, even though most Protestants would deny the idea that they were part of a settler community. But the way that they behaved, their conduct, made them into settlers. Colonization creates the settler, said the famous anti-colonial theorist Albert Memmi. You can see, actually, those identifications very clearly in any mural in Northern Ireland, where Republican solidarity murals will fly the Palestinian flag, whereas loyalist or unionist murals will include the Star of David, and indeed their pubs will fly little buntings with the Israeli flag all around them. That sense of identification with the Palestinians and with the Israelis divided the two communities and was part of what I grew up with. In other words, in a way that we'll discuss today in different terms, I've witnessed occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid in practice from a quite early part of my life, and that shaped my commitment to ending South African apartheid and to the divestment campaign in the 1980s. So I'm not making an exception of Israel, as I'm often accused of doing, of holding it to different standards of criticism than any other state would be held to. On the contrary, I'm holding it to the same standards of intellectual analysis and political practice as I did in regard to my own country, Ireland, and to South Africa, and indeed, as I continue to do insofar as the United States remains a racial state and a settler colony. We have to challenge, even as we challenge what is happening elsewhere, what is happening in this country at the same time. So, although inevitably, rightfully, Gaza is on our minds, and although it's the context for everything that we're going to talk about today, I'm going to step back from the current Israeli war on Gaza, the latest and most vicious phase, as Jake reminded us, of a series of wars that have taken place on Gaza by Israel since 2008-09 and Operation Cast Lead. And I just want to do some background work to explore what Israel is as a state. I want to think about how each term in my title, that is, occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid, shapes how we think about Israel and creates a different angle of analysis, but also orients activism in solidarity with Palestinian rights and liberation in distinct ways. So let's start with occupation. One could argue that Israel has occupied Palestine since 1948, illegally, insofar as its seizure of lands designated for a Palestinian state in the United Nations plan for partition violated international agreements. So you can see that this was the historic Palestine, the area controlled by Britain from 1919 till 1947-8. And it was just one integral place called Palestine, governed in a colonial fashion by the British. And in fact, the Black and Tans, who were the terrorist paramilitaries sent by Britain to put down the Irish Rebellion, were sent immediately after the Anglo-Irish Treaty to Palestine, where they introduced all kinds of forms of repression and torture. These two maps, I hope you can read them from the back, but basically the one on the left is the United Nations plan, which divided Israel and Palestine into two separate states in principle. You can see that Israel got the larger part, and of course most of the coast, and Palestine got the more mountainous districts to the east, and a few parts up north, and of course Gaza and part of the Sinai. That was the proposition, and Jerusalem, which is that island of dark hatching right in the middle of the map, was to be an open city. That means no one would claim sovereignty over it. It would be shared. The map here is, of course, what Israel ended up with after the 1948 Nakba, or what the Israelis call their War of Independence, though it's never clear who they were getting independence from, since the British had promised them a homeland on the land of Palestinians in 1917. Still, you can see how much they expanded and incorporated what was actually designated to be part of Palestine. So that, in a sense, is the first occupation. Though normally, when we talk about the occupation, we talk about the land that Israel took over in the course of the Six-Day War of 1967. Israel claimed that that was a preemptive war because Israel claimed Arab nations that surrounded it, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, were about to attack. Historians have shown that to be a false account of what happened. Israel knew full well that they were not going to be attacked, but used that excuse to fight a war and to actually take over the West Bank of the Jordan. The West Bank of the Jordan that had been under Jordanian rule. The Palestinians had never achieved a state there, which Israel used as a way to explain that what they were doing was not an occupation, in fact, because an occupation is supposed, according to the Fourth Geneva Convention, which was drawn up after the Second World War precisely to prevent wars of conquest and colonization, occupation that may come about as a military necessity after a conflict must be temporary. Occupation must also, according to the Geneva Convention, preserve the status quo ante, the state of affairs before conquest, until sovereignty is returned to the original sovereign. Thus, Israel says, well, the Palestinians were not sovereign, so we're not going to return it to them. And they will say, of course, that the occupation continues because there hasn't been a peace resolution. And we know that the peace resolution is long in coming because it's constantly being deferred by Israel. And Israel, according to Benjamin Netanyahu, will never allow a Palestinian state. Humanitarian law also requires, and the Geneva Convention recognizes this, that the occupying power protect the rights of all subjects who live under its occupation. Article 49 specifically proscribes the individual or mass transfer of protected persons from an occupied territory. That is, you can't transfer, as the Israelis term it, transfer Palestinians out of the occupied territories to another location, whether it be Lebanon or Egypt or Qatar or wherever else they're currently speaking about. At the same time, Article 49 also forbids the occupying power from transferring or deporting civilian populations into the territory that it occupies. That is, Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention explicitly forbids both the dispossession and displacement of Palestinians and the settlement of the occupied territory with Jewish settlers. In violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, then, since 1967, Palestinians living in the West Bank have lived under Israeli military law, subject to arbitrary detention without charges or trial, and there are 7,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails that has just been augmented by about 2,000 plus who were captured and taken hostage by Israel after October the 7th. They live in prison under arbitrary detention orders of the military commander that can be renewed without justification, certainly without publicly proclaimed evidence, for as long as it is that military commander's will. They're also subject all across Palestine, the West Bank of Palestine, to a regime of permits that regulate every aspect of their lives. And of course, more recently, to increasing settler violence designed both to intimidate and to displace Palestinians, and a settler violence that is protected, in most cases, by the presence of the Israeli army. In occupied East Jerusalem, which Israel took over in the 67 war, Palestinians are residents, not citizens of Israel, despite being subject to Israeli law and to Israeli policing. Those residency rights are always precarious and can be revoked for multiple reasons, including not having demonstrable work in the occupied East Jerusalem. It's forbidden, for example, to bring a spouse from outside occupied East Jerusalem. So if a Jerusalemite Palestinian marries a West Bank Palestinian, they are forced to forego their residency, however long their family may have been living in East Jerusalem, and they have to migrate to the West Bank. Gaza was formally occupied at the same moment and was an occupied territory from 1967 to 2005 until Israeli Prime Minister and General Ariel Sharon demanded withdrawal of the settlers from Gaza. But it remains, no matter what Israelis tell you in justification of their idea that Gaza is a hostile territory, it is actually under international law still occupied territory, precisely because Israel controls that strip by land, sea, and air. Occupation by Israel has permitted, again, against Article 49 of the Geneva Convention, the steady encroachment of Jewish settlement on Palestinian lands, extending Israel's undeclared frontiers. Israel has never, unlike any other state in the world, declared where its boundaries actually are, because its maximalist ambition is to take all of Palestine, in that historic phrase, from the river to the sea. It was, in fact, Zionists who invented the term from the river to the sea, and Palestinians who took it back as the slogan of their liberation. We can see in 1995, the Oslo Accords divided Palestine into three areas, the West Bank, I should say, sorry, divided the West Bank into three distinct areas. Area A was to be under Palestinian jurisdiction and Palestinian security control run by the Palestinian Authority. That is the little collection of areas in the light hatching. So Jericho, Ramallah up north, Nablus, and so forth. Area B was under Palestinian civil jurisdiction, but under Israeli security control, meaning that the IDF can enter Palestinian towns and villages at any time, at will. And the Palestinian Authority's police force has to stand down when they do so. And then Area C, that vast white space, is totally under Israeli security control. So when you hear Area C, you know we're talking about most 60% of the West Bank. That's where predominantly Israeli settlers have set up their settlements illegally on hilltops. And then after the IDF has protected them for a while, they will be declared official and incorporated into Israel proper, if I can use that expression. We can see the deterioration of Palestinian control over the West Bank in these maps. This is the map of West Bank 2006 that shows the areas under PA, the Palestinian Authority control, in orange, and under Israeli control, both the white and the hatched areas. The purple dots are the settlements, and you can see how strategically they are arrayed. If we had a map of the terrain, you'd see that they're mostly on hilltops for defensibility and visibility, surveillance, in other words. And Ariel Sharon, the prime minister who withdrew from Gaza, recommended that as a strategy. Here we can see 15 years later how the Palestinian Authority's area in green, so within this purple area, the green spots are now all that is left under Palestinian control. It's also, as you can see, completely fragmented. So that Israel is, in fact, able to divide Palestinians from one another. When I went to Israel to survey the state of higher education there back in 2016, I heard Palestinians say, yeah, we are subject to localization. That means communication between the different higher education facilities from Jericho in the south to Tulkarm in the north had been cut off, meaning that academic life, the kind of exchanges that we're having now, me coming down from Los Angeles to talk here in Long Beach would be impossible. It would actually take you all day to get from Los Angeles to Long Beach. Took me long enough, but not all day. Now, we have, over the years, of course, organized Palestine solidarity work in the framework of occupation. End the occupation now was our slogan when I first started in Palestine solidarity. It was assumed that that was what we wanted. End the occupation, allow a Palestinian state to come into being. It was framed within the end goal of a two-state solution. Allow the Palestinian state on the 22% of the land that remains, including what's called Area C, beyond the green line, which is what international affairs generally calls the border that separated Israel before 1967 from Palestinian territories. But it also, that organizing around occupation, allowed liberal Zionists to claim that Israel was just a normal democracy with an unfortunate and anomalous burden of the occupation that distorted Israel's true nature. So David Grossman, a very good Israeli writer that you might want to look at, this book, Writing in the Dark, it's impossible for a state to maintain true democracy while simultaneously upholding a regime of occupation and oppression. Probably true, and probably a phrase that we should reflect back on the United States. Increasingly, as a result of this, the idea that we are fighting for Palestinian liberation simply by asking for the ending of the occupation is very, very apparently insufficient. The end goal of occupation, which is of the Israeli occupation, which has always been the establishment of an Israeli state in what they call Eretz Israel, the whole of the land of Israel, which for some of them even includes large parts of the state of Jordan, from the river to the sea, in other words, has become increasingly explicit state policy, encapsulated most clearly in the One Hope plan of self-declared fascist homophobe and finance minister in Netanyahu's extreme right cabinet, Bezalel Smotrich. As you can see, what he's saying is that there is room for only one expression of national self-determination west of the Jordan River, that of the Jewish nation. In that, there is no longer any plan, even for the rump state that some liberal Zionists are offering to the Palestinians. But this is the nature of settler colonialism. Settler colonialism, which I will turn to now, is fundamentally an expansionist project. There are two different basic types of colonialism. One we call franchise colonialism, we could also just call it imperialism, which is the domination of a foreign territory for the purpose of extracting and exploiting indigenous labor to produce raw materials or manufactured goods, gold and silver in the Spanish colonization of the Americas, copper or lithium in the U.S. colonization from a distance of the Philippines or the Congo or other places where those rare metals are to be found. Sugar or tea in the plantation economies, not only of the Caribbean, but also places like India and Vietnam. All for the benefit of the home country. But usually what we call franchise colonialism doesn't try to settle any large part of its own population or displace the native population whose labor in any case that it needs. It brings in its agents, administrators, military and police, sometimes teachers, but not the settlement of a large colonial population. One can think of the U.S. colonization of the Philippines or British colonization of India or Nigeria as classic examples. In settler colonialism, to the contrary, a mother country deports or migrates its own population to settle in the colony, and necessarily, in order to place them on the land, dispossesses and displaces the native or indigenous population from the land. It seeks to create a new polity in that land, giving the settler provisional sovereignty and legal and military protection at first, until the settlers develop their own capacity for military force and self-protection. Usually, settler colonialism also claims that it is developing the land, exploiting its resources more efficiently and productively than did the backward natives. As you know, Israel has always claimed that it made the fertile land of Palestine, which occupies what was always called the Fertile Crescent, it took that wilderness and made the desert bloom. In the case of Israel as a settler colony, early Zionists made no bones about it. As Edward Said points out, in general, the Zionists were not afraid to say that their enterprise was a colonial one. Similarly, Zev Yabotinsky, the extreme Zionist of the 1920s, said that every indigenous people will resist alien settlers as long as they see any hope of ridding themselves of the danger of foreign settlement. This is how the Arabs will behave and go on behaving, so long as they possess a gleam of hope that they can prevent Palestine from becoming the land of Israel. He recognizes the existence of a Palestinian people, as he puts it in the next quote, they are a living people, which of course a series of Israeli prime ministers, including Golda Meir, have always denied that there was actually ever a Palestinian people, but there was, and Palestinians have always been a living people. Patrick Wolfe, who's one of the principal theorists of settler colonialism, established three main characteristics of settler colonialism. First, settler colonialism demands the transfer of these alien settlers onto the land and the dispossession and displacement of the indigenous people. Secondly, it demands the elimination of the native, which can mean killing, but there are other ways of eliminating a people, such as education, for example. Settler colonialism, he thirdly says, is a structure and not an event. Colonialism isn't something that happens one year and then we're done. It's something that repeats itself. And settler colonialism in particular, because eliminating the native takes a long time. In the Israeli case, both the elimination of the native and the ongoing structure of the settler colonial process are evident. The catastrophe of 1947-8, called the Nakba in Arabic, led to 750,000 Palestinians being expelled from historic Palestine, from their homes, and the massacre of many Palestinians in their villages, many of which, in the hundreds, were destroyed and replaced by Israeli settlements. The ongoing Nakba means the continuing expulsion, displacement, and concentration of Palestinian populations in shrinking areas of historic Palestine. The threatened expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza during the current war that has been voiced by most of the Israeli government at one time or other since October constitutes, as Palestinians say, a second Nakba. This demographic time bomb that I allude to there is the racist anxiety that it's akin to replacement theory of white supremacists that I was familiar with from Northern Ireland and you're all familiar with from what happened in 2016 in the first year of Trump's election. In order to justify its elimination of the native population, to prevent them from becoming a majority or having the political rights to exercise effectively, settler colonialism has to establish a strict division between the settler population and the indigenous people. It's what Frantz Fanon called the Manichaean nature of the colony, the separation that's both material and spatial, different neighborhoods, different schools and social organizations like in Jim Crow, differential access to legal rights, and it's also ideological. The colonized are seen as barbarous, backward, essentially violent terrorists, or as human animals, as Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said. Now, apartheid is, in fact, not something that we have to understand only by analogy with South Africa. Apartheid has the very specific definition of this gulf between the culture of the colonialist and the colonized, and the exploitation of these differences for the benefit of the colonialist. That was Albert Memmi writing in 1956. Under international law, it was the Rome Convention of the 1990s that defined apartheid, not, as you'll see by reference to South Africa, but as a particular structure of rule. When any inhuman or inhumane act, essentially a serious human rights violation, is perpetrated in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another, with the intention to maintain that system. Apartheid, the Rome Statute goes on, can best be understood as a system of prolonged and cruel discriminatory treatment by one racial group of members of another with the intention to control that second group. No better definition of what is happening in Israel could be given than that it is an apartheid state, following those. Within Israel itself, over 65 laws penalize Palestinians in one way or another. I'm going to skip forward to this because we're running out of time and I want to leave some time to talk with you all. We've seen what's happened in the West Bank in occupied East Jerusalem. but in what Palestinians call 48 Palestine, that is, the state of Israel, there are over 65 laws, according to ADLA, the Arab Human Rights Organization in Israel itself, that discriminate against Palestinians. You can look up this database. It's right there. Just go to ADLA, and it's right there on their front page. You can connect to it and see what these laws are. Now, just as Israel fragments Palestinian land, so it fragments its system of apartheid, so that it constantly can say, well, you know, there are Palestinian judges in Israel. There are, you know, Arab members of the army, et cetera, et cetera. That's not the point. The point is that a whole tissue of disparate laws come together to form a constellation of law and discrimination that constitutes apartheid as part of a system and not merely an accident of prejudice, a system of domination. So, as a crime defined in this way under international law, apartheid demands our action to dismantle it. When South Africa took Israel to the International Court of Justice in late November, December, it did so because international law requires states that are party to the International Court of Justice to bring one another to court if they see them practicing forms of discrimination, including apartheid, or any other breach of international or humanitarian law, and are not responding to efforts to get them to cease. So what South Africa did is not something that only states can do or are bound to do. As a crime, apartheid demands our action to dismantle it. No state form that institutionalizes apartheid in the way we can show Israel to have done can claim to be exempted from sanction or condemnation. Palestinian liberation entails the complete transformation of the current state of Israel, just as the dismantling of South African apartheid, while that is still an unfinished project, saw the end of white domination and the groundwork of a state of equality under the law. It was, in part, the dismantling of South African apartheid, the end result of a long campaign on college campuses, in sports and culture, in civil society organizations, from churches and synagogues to union halls, that enforced our institutions to divest from companies that supported apartheid and eventually to bring the Reagan administration to end what it called its congagement with the South African apartheid regime. So we have a playbook. In the 1980s, we organized for divestment, and we won it. In the UC system, finally, we won divestment, and eventually we got Washington itself to impose the next step of such a campaign, which is sanctions against South Africa. And we have a moment. Just as post-apartheid South Africa has stepped up to bring charges of genocide against Israel in the International Court of Justice, and just as, even as I'm speaking to you, the International Court of Justice is hearing accusations from over 50 states internationally that Israel is practicing breaches of international and humanitarian law and practicing apartheid. So it's incumbent on us to take this struggle for justice to Palestine into our own institutions and call for our institutions to divest from all investments in Israel until its apartheid regime is brought to an end and a state of equality for all its citizens is realized from the river to the sea. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Boyd. So we handed out some index cards. If you haven't yet put a question on them, we can pass them to some direction, maybe this way, and we can pick those up and start asking Dr. Boyd some questions. Do you have any questions written down yet? So I'll read them out loud and,
yeah.
Okay. A recent UN Security Council proposal for an immediate ceasefire was vetoed by the US. Of the 15 states on the council, 13 voted in favor of the ceasefire. The UN abstained.
Oh, you have to abstain. I can't read it. Why does U.S. support this Israeli government so vehemently?
Well, the first answer, I suppose, is a personal answer, in that Joe Biden, your president, has, ever since he became a politician, being supportive, in fact, an ardent Zionist, I think he describes himself as. There's very little daylight between the Biden administration and the fascist regime that Benjamin Netanyahu heads up in now Jerusalem. So there is that aspect of Biden's obduracy and his insistence on supporting Israel, even in the midst of its ongoing violations of not only international and humanitarian law, but U.S. policy. U.S. policy, for example, has constantly declared the settlements illegal and never done anything to stop them. So the fact that Biden continues to send weapons to Israel, 2,000-ton bombs that are being dropped on Palestinian homes and demolishing large dwellings down into rubble, that's part of his mentality, but it's also continuous with U.S. support for Israel. So we need to ask why even Obama was unwilling to intervene to stop Israel from its attack on Gaza that was taking place as Obama was inaugurated. And I think that the first structural answer to that is that the U.S. is a settler colony too. The U.S. has a history of massacre, genocide, not just back in the Indian Wars of the 19th century, but now. Before the war on Iraq of 2003, President Clinton, sanctioned Iraq in continuity with the previous George Bush Sr. regime in Washington, and 500,000 children died as a result, direct result, of U.S. sanctions, from malnutrition, from lack of medication, and so forth. And his Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, was asked in a TV interview whether she felt that it was worth such a cost of human life. And this is not even talking about the adults who died. And she said, yes, we think it's worth the cost. Think about that for a moment. 500,000 children in 10 years. So U.S. policy has always been to support regimes that it sees as sharing its own worldview. Israel claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East and has had a long history of acting as if it were the U.S. representative in the region. And the U.S. supports it, just as it supports authoritarian regimes around the world that defend its interests. So my suspicion is that Israel is not doing too well in this war. If you look at sources other than the mainstream media, if, for example, you look at the gray zone, or if you look at Electronic Intifada, you will see that they're doing weekly reports on the resistance to the Israeli invasion and war on Gaza right now. And whatever your feelings about armed resistance, you will actually see that the armed resistance is continuing in all parts of Gaza to take a toll on the Israeli army. In other words, the tactics of counterinsurgency are not working. When George Bush Jr. went into Iraq, people said to me, oh, it's great, we've got the UK on our side, as the US has the UK on its side right now. And I said, yeah, 30 years in Belfast, and what did they gain? They lost. So are you ready for 30 years in Iraq? Because that's what the British experienced. Counterinsurgency constantly fails, but counterinsurgency cannot be allowed to fail, because the whole of the Western European alliance, NATO, in conjunction with Israel, is predicated on the practice of counterinsurgency. That's what the war on terror has been about. That's what the anti-colonial wars are about. Before the British came to Northern Ireland, they had practiced what they practiced in Northern Ireland, in Aden, in Kenya, in Malaysia, as it was then called. So counterinsurgency is the post-colonial way in which the West manages the world. So Israel cannot be allowed to fail. And I think that's a fundamental reason why the U.S. continues to arm Israel, even in the face of the genocidal acts that it's committing. So I don't know if that's a sufficient answer. But
right. Yeah, we have several questions.
Yep.
I'm going totally randomly. They're kind of coming in. I just put them under the stack. Okay. So the next question is, why has the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, ruled that Israel is committing genocide, yet there have not been steps taken to stop it?
Slight correction there. The ICJ did not rule that Israel is committing genocide, because that's matter for an investigation that unfortunately will probably take several years to conclude. What it agreed with South Africa on, unfortunately, was not that there should be immediate ceasefire, not in those terms, not in that bold statement, which we need, but rather that Israel should cease to commit actions that would appear to be genocidal in their nature. In other words, go on fighting your war, but let's stop massacring civilians. Let's stop destroying their infrastructure. Let's stop shattering their schools and universities and reducing them to rubble. In my view, Israel is incapable of fighting this war without conducting those actions, because it's not going to put its ground troops face to face with Hamas or with the Islamic Jihad. It's afraid to lose too many soldiers because the Israeli public hates to lose people. So it's going to have to continue to fight with tanks and shelling and bombing and shelling from the ocean. And so the war will continue, and Israel will continue in these practices that the ICJ has said are plausibly genocidal acts. So the reason it stood back, I don't know, perhaps because there was no proof, and insufficient proof could not allow it to say there must be a ceasefire. Of course, it's not being imposed, because the nation states that have the power to impose the ICJ's rulings are mostly backing Israel. The UK, France, Germany. Interestingly, what we're looking at is actually a list of states that perpetrated genocidal colonialism around the world. So perhaps that's the answer why the ICJ has not been able to have its ruling enforced. And we'll see. It's almost a month since that ruling came down, so we'll see if Israel is going to produce its report explaining how it has ceased to conduct genocidal acts in Gaza while killing 150 to 200 civilians a day.
Great. So I have the next question. Where can we find the origins of From the River to the Sea, and how can we disprove it is anti-Semitic?
I will just send you to an excellent article in the journal Mondo Weiss. Mondo Weiss is a publication, online publication, that gives you daily news and articles about what's happening across Palestine and, of course, also in the United States. And a few months ago, a very, very fine scholar called Elliot Colla wrote a piece, that's C-O-L-L-A, if you want to look it up. Elliot Koller wrote a wonderful story about what the origins of From the River to the Sea entails, which I was effectively citing in my own talk just now. But basically, From the River to the Sea was the way in which Zionists thought about their own project. Eretz Israel means, Eretz is Greater Israel. It means the whole of the land of Israel from the Jordan River to the coast. Now, it's thousands of years since any Israeli state occupied that whole territory, in fact. And indeed, if you look at the Bible, for most of the time, Israel never actually occupied all of that area. But that's the maximalist claim that Israel makes. And so, From the River to the Sea was the Zionist slogan. When Palestinians say, From the River to the Sea, what they are recognizing is the map that I've just given you. As a settler colonial entity, Israel practices its domination of Palestinians in different ways in different parts of historic Palestine. On the West Bank, it's martial law. permit regimes. In occupied East Jerusalem, it's residency and the precariousness of residency. In 48 Palestine, it's the nationality law, which I didn't get to go into, which basically says, it was passed in 2018 under the last Netanyahu government, the nationality law basically says this is a state for Jews and Jews only. You can look it up. Again, Adala, A-D-A-L-A-H, has a breakdown of the nationality law and what it means. So in Gaza, it's been under siege and blockade 16, 17 years. So each part of Palestine is regulated by different systems. The diaspora, which we should never forget, because there's 5 to 7 million Palestinians living in the diaspora, many of whom are here now, I think. The diaspora is also subject to Israeli apartheid, because if you're Palestinian or even Muslim, or if your name is Arabic, you are warned by our State Department not to travel to Israel because you may be subject to interrogation, strip searching, and worse at the point of entry, and you may be denied entry. That means every one of our education abroad programs in Israel violates our university's principles of non-discrimination, because not everybody can go. Can't even go if you're a member of SJP, in fact. So Israeli apartheid is articulated through these very, very different systems that come together into a single system. Have I answered the question?
Right, sure.
Yeah. Okay.
We have about several others.
All right.
I understand some students are probably 12, 15, maybe.
And please, you know, feel free to interrupt. I know we're doing the questions from the cards, but I'm not afraid of discussion. So if you have objections and want to raise them, please do. Or if you want me to nuance something, please ask.
I just have
yes.
A question.
Yeah.
Is there a harshness related to their view of Palestine and the Bible?
I beg your pardon. I'm sorry. Well, certainly, for example, Benjamin Netanyahu invoked the biblical story of the genocide against the Amalekites, who were a Canaanite people when the Israelis came into what they thought of as the Promised Land. They claimed that Jehovah told them to slaughter all, not just you know, the fighters, but everybody, men, women, children, and their animals. And that's what Netanyahu invokes. So he's whistling very, very loudly. This isn't just a little dog whistle. This is a very loud whistle to his troops, to his military, to his civilians, that genocide is okay. On the other hand, Zionism was always a secular movement. Herzl, the founder of Zionism, was totally uninterested in religion, and yet was willing to invoke the Old Testament as the reason why Jews should return there. So I don't think the Bible is the reason that they are so harsh to Palestinians.
More like a tool.
Yeah, it's a tool, exactly. It's a rationale that can be given, particularly because, of course, the largest number of Zionists in this country are not Jewish. They're actually Christians, the Christian Zionist movement, the evangelicals, who want to see, it's lovely, they want to see all Jews return to Israel, because at that point all Jews will be massacred by the Lord and the rapture will take place. So Netanyahu loves the Christian Zionists because they serve his purposes, but they actually, you know, are the most anti-Semitic people. So Zionism is an interesting thing. Yeah.
Good. So next card question. You spoke about external pressure as a necessary part of stopping the brutal attack on Gaza. What, if any, is the best way for us students to support and push for a ceasefire?
BDS. So boycott, divestment, and sanctions. There's a logic to boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It's not just a bunch of actions you can take. The reason many of us turned to supporting BDS, and in particular the cultural and academic boycott of Israeli institutions back in 2009, and started what we call US ACBI, the US Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, was because during Operation Cast Lead, when 2,000 Palestinians had already died in that assault, Obama came into office and did nothing to stop the slaughter. And all but four senators and congresspeople voted to support Israel and told a bunch of lies while they were doing it. We knew that the political process was blocked. We wrote a letter that 1,000 people signed calling on Obama to sanction Israel, and he didn't. That means you have to turn to civil society organizations. That means it starts with you as individuals. Individuals can boycott. You can stop going to Starbucks. It's actually not on the list of boycott targets officially of the BDS movement, but the CEO of Starbucks does send money to the Jewish National Fund, which takes land from Palestinians and restricts it for Jewish-only use. But you can boycott all kinds. You can stop buying Hewlett-Packard printers, for example, because Hewlett-Packard actually serves up the Israelis with the IT equipment that they need to maintain their security checkpoints and so forth. You can go to a list called Who Profits and find out if there's any corporations you're familiar with that are supporting Israel. So boycott is something you can start doing as an individual, but which will lead you to organize collectively, because it's much more impressive if a group of students go to Starbucks and stand outside explaining to people why they shouldn't be drinking Starbucks, apart from the fact that it's really bad for you and is lousy coffee and you should be buying free trade coffee instead. But apart from that, you need to start forming movements which give people a sense of ownership. If I boycott something, then I get mad when my university continues to sell Sabra hummus, which is made in the settlements. So you begin to organize together, and at a certain point, you develop a critical mass of students who are capable of beginning to demand divestment of our universities. Our divestment is from portfolios that the university maintains of its investments, which may well be invested in the armaments industries, in Raytheon and Boeing, which may be invested in Caterpillar, which sells the bulldozers, the D9s, that are now flattening Palestinian buildings in Gaza. We can't boycott Caterpillar, but we can demand that our institutions divest from them. So that's the next step. And this is what the South Africa campaign was based on. We divest from all firms doing business with South Africa until South African apartheid ends. We do the same with Israel. We divest from all corporations supporting it. And it's worked. There have been, go to the BDS campaign's website and you will discover how many times corporations ranging from Norwegian pension funds to Veolia, the French transport system, have withdrawn their business.
So if I may, so it is 12:15. I'd like to invite student activists from SJP to have an announcement. And then those who can stay an extra 10 minutes with Dr. Lloyd, are feel free to. If you need to get to class, you can bounce. But SJP, come on up. And then we'll go through questions again. So we have a quick announcement.
I guess we're the only ones coming up there. No, I'm sorry.
All right, we have an announcement, everybody, from SJP.
Okay. Hi, everybody. So we are a part of the Students for Justice in Palestine organization here on campus. And we are fairly new. We're trying to build back up, you know, especially after what Dr. Wilson talked about, after that SJP kind of disbanded. So now we're back here trying to build back up SJP and an SJP presence. So we're kind of figuring out where we want to go from here, but I think the main thing that we're trying to focus on is divestment, as well as being in the coalition of students against tuition hikes, demanding that our money goes to us as students and not for war manufacturing companies, not for policing and militarization, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, if you're interested, you want to follow us.
So we have our Instagram, SJP at CSUOB, and we are also trying to raise awareness, so we're going to try to have movie screenings and teach-ins and all of that, and ways to help in any way. there someone?
What are the companies we're divesting from?
So there's Raytheon, there's Lockheed Martin,
I know for sure Raytheon. I don't know about the other ones though.
I'm still trying to get information on that.
I know for sure also Lockheed Martin. So there are companies that are complicit in the genocide in the sense that they are manufacturing missiles and all of that. And there's other companies that are supporting Israel with their money, like Sabra and like HP and Puma and all of these things. So.
What are some of the suggestions you
So on this campus, we've had rallies, vigils, die-ins, banner drops. We've had a meeting with our members who are interested. And we've had a lot of pushback from administration. So it's really hard to kind of, in that kind of environment with the lack of safety, to kind of like mobilize and actually do a lot of events, but we're trying our best to kind of keep everyone safe and to fight back the administration and their kind of language as well.
Yeah, definitely a lot of teach-ins y'all should look forward to in the future. We really want to push this divestment campaign, especially because, you know, I believe it was UC Davis who just recently got their divestment passed. Yeah. So, you know, we really need to use this momentum so, you know, we can go to the Board of Trustees and we can go to our campus president. We can go to the chancellor and be like, hey, we need to do something. We, you know, especially with our tuition hikes as well, tuition rising. It's all interconnected. And, you know, if you guys want to help join the fight, join the organizing, you know, follow us at SJP at CSULB. We look forward to hearing from you guys and getting your guys' input and help. I know there was a hand right here.
That was me. I was about to point out UC Davis maybe like going to them and asking what worked for them. So
yeah.
That you don't, you know, just keep doing the same things and not get any, you know,
yeah.
The results. But also, just as a reminder, if there's any people graduating, make sure you decorate your caps, make sure your photo shoots show pride. I think it makes everybody feel like there's more solidarity. And I mean, I'm noticing, you know, the protests in Redondo, everybody's starting to wake up. Remember, not everybody's woken up yet. And we're all on different journeys. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. I appreciate that.
But a round of applause for student activists. Cool. Hi, Julia. So, hey, everybody. This is totally random. Yesterday, I went to EAT, and I have never met Julia, but we were both wearing Palestinian solidarity clothing, and we talked, and now Julia's here. Thank you for coming.
And if you want to hear about upcoming actions, you can come talk to us after this.
All right. So, if you want to stick around, we have about one or two more questions. Dr. Lloyd, what reliable sources would you recommend we keep up with in order to remain updated on Palestine?
Well, one of them's up there. So I'm just waiting for a little quiet, and then I'll answer.
Well, if you can just hold down the chatter real quick. We're going to do one more question. Okay. Last question of the day, and then we can... Thank Dr. Lloyd one more time.
So I think it is really important to find sources outside the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or even the Guardian that are corporate media in one sense or another. One that I would recommend, I've already mentioned, is Mondo Weiss, which has on the ground reporters from Palestine. Another that I would recommend, obviously, is Al Jazeera, which has reporters, many of whom have been killed. Over 120 reporters have been killed in the latest Israeli war on Gaza, and many before in other situations. I would also recommend Electronic Intifada, which has a live stream every week now. If you just go to electronicintifada.org, you'll find that. They have an incredible record of publishing voices from Palestine. I mentioned the poet, English professor Rafat Al-Arir, who was assassinated in December by an Israeli rocket that appears to have been targeted from the evidence that has been assembled so far. And he worked with Electronic Intifada introducing students like yourselves, like now, or not all of you, but some of you in this room, who started becoming reporters on the ground, telling their stories. Also, We Are Not Numbers, which is another thing that he launched with a number of other people, in which Gazans tell their own story, so they're not just statistics. So Electronic Intifada has been doing an extraordinary job lately in covering what is going on, in analyzing, in breaking down the lies that Israeli propaganda is telling, including such things as this unsubstantiated report of coordinated sexual assault that Hamas is supposed to have committed, for which there is no evidence at all that does come not come from highly suspect sources like separate organizations. So you need to be really, really suspicious of what you're hearing. They broke down the New York Times' story on those accusations with incredible fine-grained critique and showed that it was just preposterous what this guy was claiming, including one of the families who said, no, our sister was not raped. She was killed, but we have no evidence at all that she was raped. Within the New York Times itself, the reporter's colleagues repudiated his story as badly done. And, you know, that sort of stuff happens all the time. Whenever Israel goes to war, the first weapon it sends out is what it calls hasbara, or propaganda. So the other thing is to look at non-US sources wherever you can. The Guardian is a lot better than the New York Times, for example. But you can go beyond that. I read the Irish Times, which gives you at least an Irish perspective, which has been largely in solidarity with Palestine. And you'll get a different impression there. If you have other languages, read the Spanish language press, read the Brazilian press. You know, so you just get a different sense of what is going on. I put up a bibliography there. We're running a series called Understanding Palestine out of our Center for Ideas and Society at UCR. And I put together a bibliography that will continue to grow depending on what speakers think are important sources. But you can find a lot of important historical background there. And those would be some good places to start. I know you don't have much time in your day, but the great thing about Electronic Intifada is you can actually get their live streams as podcasts, so you can listen to them while you're driving to work or to school.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. One more round of applause.
Well, thank you all for being here.